Hello, this is Carol Bond reading with you today the August 11th issue of the Decatur Herald and Review. We'll begin with an article of local interest. The headline is "More Wolf Likely Next Mayor." This was written by Allison Petty. The Decatur City Council is expected to appoint Mayor Pro Tempore Julie Moore Wolf to fill the vacancy created by Mayor Mike McElroy's death. Under state law, the council has 60 days from McElroy's July 17th death to fill the position, which Moore Wolf has held in the interim. All six council members met in closed session for about 45 minutes Monday to discuss the matter. City Manager Tim Gleason said afterward that the council had directed him to prepare a resolution for its August 17th meeting to appoint Moore Wolf, who would serve until the next general election in spring 2017. The council would then seek interested residents to fill her council seat. Moore Wolf expressed mixed emotions Monday. "I had never aspired to be mayor, and this is the worst possible way to become mayor," she said. "But I'm very humbled by the faith that has been placed in me by my fellow council members." The Director of Community and Government Relations for Decatur Memorial Hospital, Moore Wolf, age 55, has served on the council for 6 years. It is believed that she would be the city's first female mayor. If she were to run in the 2017 mayoral election, Moore Wolf would be seeking a 2-year term. She said Monday that it was probably too early to say whether she would do so. "I never really thought of myself as much of a politician, just wanting to serve. We'll see how this goes," she said. Councilman Jerry Dawson said he viewed Moore Wolf's appointment as fulfilling McElroy's wishes. "He personally picked her to be mayor pro tem. If there's anything I can do to fulfill his wish, I'm going to do it," Dawson said. "With that being said, I think she's most capable. I wouldn't support anybody if I didn't think they could do it." Several speakers at the August 3rd council meeting indicated support for Moore Wolf. Others voiced a strong desire for the appointment of G.E. Livingston, who placed second to McElroy in the April election with 36% of the vote. Moore Wolf said the council felt that the mayoral position comes with a learning curve. "A candidate from the council would bring the experience needed to continue in the direction McElroy wanted, and that voters supported by electing him," she said. "We're very interested in hearing the voice of the community, and maybe some of the folks that were here that evening are interested in the appointment to council. We'll see," she said. "It's important that we get the best person to represent the city." Councilman Pat McDaniel joked that council members had probably scheduled root canals that would be easier than choosing someone to fill the vacant council spot. "You know, in a process like that, you want to find the right person for the position that represents all the community, and that because we all are elected at large," he said. In terms of what's next, Moore Wolf said the council's job is to make sure that public safety is in place and infrastructure needs are met. That includes less glamorous projects such as sewers, bridges, and dredging of Lake Decatur. "We are in a good place. There's revitalization in this community, and it's an exciting time to be a part of it," she said. "We're going to continue making great things happen." She said others have asked if she had time to devote to the position. In answer, she cited past experience of working full-time while her three children, now 19, 20, and 25, were younger and involved in sports and other activities. Ask any mom of three kids who works full-time and who volunteers, she said. This is probably a lot easier. The next article of particular local interest is this: H&R seeks Vietnam War vets' stories. The Herald and Review is launching a project to honor Vietnam War veterans as the nation marks the 50th anniversary of when the U.S. sent combat troops. While the exact beginning of the Vietnam War is subject to debate, 1965 has been selected as the date because it is the first year that regular U.S. combat units were deployed to Southeast Asia, and it is also when the American ground war began. Those who served will appear daily in the Herald and Review, starting September 23rd and running through Veterans Day, November 11th. It will recognize the service and contributions of 50 living veterans with stories and photographs. Those who served also will appear daily on heraldreview.com. We know there are more than 50 veterans in our circulation area who served with distinction in Vietnam, said managing editor Dave Dawson. Every veteran, no matter when or where they served, deserves our thanks and gratitude. We believe this project is one way the Herald and Review can recognize the efforts of everyone who served in Vietnam. Veterans interested in participating will answer a series of questions and will be asked to submit a current photograph as well as some from their service in Vietnam. Veterans will be asked basic information such as his or her branch of service, years of service, rank, and special honors, but also questions about personal recollections of their service. Should there be more than 50 veterans nominated, we will ask those who are not selected to submit a photo with name, rank, military branch, and years of service so we can run a photo gallery on heraldreview.com. Veterans should live within the Herald and Review circulation area. Those who wish to be among the 50 veterans selected for the project should send their name, town, daytime telephone number, and email address to hrnews@herald-review.com. Those without email can send a written note to managing editor Dave Dawson at the Herald and Review, 601 East William Street, Decatur, 62523. Submission deadline is 5 p.m. Monday, September 7th. Our next story comes from Sangamon Valley. Sangamon Valley officials have new jobs, new goals. This was written by Valerie Wells, H&R staff writer, and the dateline is Niantic. Most of the faces are familiar, but many job titles have changed. Sangamon Valley's former superintendent, Ernie Fowler, left in June for a position in Nashville, Illinois. The school board named Robert Bob Meadows, Sangamon Valley High School principal, as his replacement. Of course, that left the principal's position open, and Jonathan Field, who was previously the middle school principal, was moved to that job. Cody Trigg was moved to middle school principal from his position at Sangamon Valley West, the elementary school in Iliopolis. Fifth grade teacher Brian Britton was hired to be principal for that school. And when Jill Reedy left her position as principal at Sangamon Valley East, the elementary school in Harristown, teacher Valerie Janvrin was named principal to fill that post. One of the things that I'm going to try to do with the board is improve the facilities, Meadows said. We can utilize the Macon County sales tax money to do that and try to relieve some of the burden off taxpayers. The budget cuts and cuts in personnel that Ernie Fowler did, that he started 7 years ago, has put us in a position to be able to do that. Remodeling has begun on the high school library with new paint and carpet and additional computers to make it more of a media resource center. With 16 computers, 25 Chromebooks, and a new librarian, Erica Bryan, Meadows said the library should be an inviting place. The school board had met in the library, Meadows said, and their meeting area will now be freed for students. In addition, there are plans to remodel two classrooms at the middle school and put tile in the chorus room. The middle and high school buildings are about a century old, Janvrin said. Remodeling and repairs are all the district can afford, even with the sales tax revenue. Field's plans are to revamp the curriculum in the high school with an eye toward the best preparation for students for college and career. In a small school, he said, it's more difficult to offer a wide variety of courses. Middle school students will have greater access to technology thanks to a Monsanto grant secured by Trigg's efforts. He hopes the $6,500 will be enough for 30 iPads to be kept on two carts and shared among middle school classes. We turn now to one more article about education. And the headline of this one is Alternative Education Celebrates Homecoming. And this also was written by Valerie Wells. Now that Decatur's two high schools are finished with renovations, Stephen Decatur Middle School is moving back to its Mound Road location over the summer. The former Decatur Area Technical Academy building on El Dorado and Jackson Streets will now be known as the Alternative Education Center, a return to its previous function. The building itself looks like an alternative education building, said Rocky Wilkerson, executive director of adult education for Decatur Schools. It has options, which is good. It's really the best kept secret in Decatur. Decatur Public Schools are educating pre-K through 12, but there's also an outlet to assist families who need it just as much as kids. The Regional Office of Education has operated the downtown Macon Piatt Adult Education Center for years, but that closed at the end of May, leaving the downtown area with no outlet for adults who need a GED or other help improving skills. Richland Community College offers those services, and Decatur Schools Education and Training Center has been at Hickory Point Mall for 8 years. We're used to having three options. Now we're down to two, Wilkerson said. That's a loss for our area. While the emphasis used to be on helping people obtain a GED, the new focus is on bridge programs, she said. Adult education is there to provide help for people to complete the steps to move to post-secondary education and ultimately employment. For some clients, that starts with a GED. For others, it's brushing up on skills, moving into basic work skills training, then more specific job training. The grants that pay for much of the adult education programs in the nation have changed, and government requirements for those programs have changed too. The Education and Training Center will offer 4 bridge programs in the fall, which will be housed at the El Dorado Street location: Certified Nurse Assistant, Hospitality, Manufacturing, and Construction. The best way to define bridge is an 8-week program for people with a 4.0, that is, fourth grade, to 8.9, freshman in high school, reading level, which I consider the front door to anybody walking into adult ed who maybe didn't finish high school, looking for a new pathway to employment, and who may have barriers, she said. All kinds of things can be barriers, from unreliable transportation or childcare to a student's health issues. Wilkerson said she and her staff get students connected to the services that can break down those barriers, and the classes offered can move a student from low skills to job ready. If that student sticks with the classes and does his or her part. The Regional Office of Education's Milligan Academy Safe School will also move to the former Tech Academy this summer. There is also talk of moving Futures Unlimited to that building, though nothing is finalized. That building will be an alternative education center, and eventually all those programs will be there, and the regional office and Decatur will share space and use it for Decatur students and Macon and Piatt County students as well, just like in the past, said Regional Superintendent Matt Snyder. The regional office will remain where it is, he said. The GED test has become more difficult. Students must take it online, and the cost is considerably higher. Snyder said the goal used to be to get as many students into GED as possible, but so many fewer are actually passing the test that the focus there has shifted. Now, adult education serves fewer students, but devotes more resources to those students. For the amount of money we were spending before, I don't think it was beneficial to spend that much on so few students passing, he said. They can utilize the money better in preparing students for work. Another article of local interest has this headline: Durbin backs stable transit spending. The dateline is Decatur, and this was written by Chris Lusvardi. U.S. Senator Dick Durbin, Democrat, Illinois, sees a long-term transportation spending plan as essential to enabling projects such as the Midwest Inland Port in Decatur to continue moving forward. Durbin said Monday during a tour of the Archer Daniels Midland Company intermodal rail facility that the Senate has approved a 6-year transportation bill across party lines. He said the House needs to approve the plan in September to provide stability for the country's major transportation and infrastructure programs. I wish it was more, Durbin said. It was nothing short of a political miracle. The last long-term transportation bill expired in 2009, which Durbin said has been followed by a series of stopgap measures to keep the transportation programs from shutting down. Products can be shipped all over the country through the Midwest Inland Port, Durbin said. The system can lead to companies creating jobs in the Decatur area, he said. It really is the heart of opportunity for Decatur and Central Illinois, Durbin said. The inland port is one of the investments being made to create economic development opportunities in Decatur, said Julie Moore Wolf, the city's mayor pro tempore. We see this as a way to address high unemployment in Decatur, Moore Wolf said. We believe the future is limitless in terms of potential opportunity. The initial investment from ADM to create the intermodal rail facility has opened opportunities for the entire region, said Scott Fredrickson, ADM Transportation President. To understand the project's full potential impact, the results of state transportation studies will be important, said State Senator Andy Maynard, Democrat from Bunker Hill. There will be increased stress on roads, and we need to know how to move freight out of Decatur, Maynard said. All these things need to come together if we are to continue to make the push. We know we have the right team in place to make it happen. Continued investment in rail and highway assets is important, said Larry Altenbaumer, executive director of the Midwest Inland Port Development Committee. It is my belief this is the single most important economic development opportunity this region has seen, he said. Altenbaumer said the plan is for a comprehensive marketing study for the Midwest Inland Port to be rolled out beginning in September. Now let's take a look at the news of crime and the courts. This is written by Tony Reed, and the dateline is Decatur. Woman allegedly beaten, leaving tot alone in bathtub. A Decatur man is being held in jail on charges he beat and restrained his girlfriend, who is also the mother of his child, leaving the one-year-old boy sitting alone in a bathtub full of water. The 26-year-old suspect was arrested Friday and booked on charges of endangering the life and health of a child, domestic battery involving bodily harm, and unlawful restraint. His girlfriend, 23, had told police she and the suspect, her boyfriend of 3 years, had been arguing on the night of August 1st when he accused her of cheating on him after he found a text message on her phone. He allegedly had walked into the bathroom while she was bathing their son and, grabbing her by the back of the neck, pushed and pulled her into the bedroom, forcing her onto the bed. While the child was left alone in the tub, police allege the suspect sat on his girlfriend's chest with his knees pinning her arms and interrogated her about his cheating suspicions. She begged for him to let her up so she could get their son from the bathtub, Officer Mike Claypool said in a sworn statement. While she was pinned to the bed, the suspect delivered an open-hand slap to the left side of her face. This caused severe pain. After a period of time not specified in the sworn statement, the girlfriend was able to get up and retrieve her son from the tub. But while she was putting him to bed, the suspect again allegedly grabbed her and dragged her out of the child's bedroom, holding her by the neck and again forcing her onto their bed. Police allege she had to lay with him there all night, and in the morning he refused to let her use her own car to drive herself to work and drop her son and another 5-year-old child off at her mother's. The suspect allegedly drove her to work and returned home with the children. when the girlfriend's mother later called to check on the children's welfare. The 5-year-old answered the front door and told her the suspect had just fled out the back door of their house. The suspect remains held without bond in the Macon County Jail. Dave Fope of the Lee News Service submits this article, Dateline St. Louis, Windsor Man Accused of Fraud. A Windsor man with a history of convictions for taking payments for, but not delivering, equipment he claimed to be selling, now faces a federal charge alleging the same type of activity. Jason L. Cripe is accused of taking money from 2 people in the St. Louis area in February, but never delivering the equipment they thought they were buying, according to a federal indictment. Cripe, age 38, didn't own the equipment, but posted it for sale online, specifically the Craigslist site, and used mail to communicate with the buyers, leading to the federal wire fraud charges, the indictment alleges. Records in his case indicate that he was arrested in St. Louis on July 8th, when he also allegedly fought with and injured arresting federal officers. The indictment also includes an assault charge in connection with that incident. Information in the federal case says Cripe claimed to own and be able to deliver 2 small tractors and accepted $12,800 in down payments, traveling from Illinois to Missouri to arrange the sales. The indictment also alleges he gave the purchasers a false address in Highland, Illinois, near St. Louis, and later changed his phone number so he couldn't be contacted. The interstate travel and email and phone contact with the purchasers and the posting of the equipment for sale online meant the incident came under federal jurisdiction, the indictment says. Cripe is in federal custody and pleaded not guilty to the charges in the indictment, but there are no hearings scheduled in his case. According to information from the U.S. Attorney's Office, a conviction for the fraud charge could bring up to 20 years in prison and a maximum fine of $250,000, with restitution also required. Cripe's history of similar crimes includes a 2012 conviction in Coles County in a case in which he also allegedly accepted a down payment but never delivered the equipment he was claiming to sell. He received a prison sentence in that case, and records show he also served prison time for similar convictions from 4 other counties. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the August 11th issue of the Decatur Herald and Review. Please stay tuned.